everyone, and welcome to Better Done Than Perfect, the podcast for SaaS founders and product people. Today, our awesome guest is Lucy Huskings, an early stage startup marketing advisor, and we're going to talk about your go-to-market strategy. This show is brought to you by UserList, the best way for SaaS founders to send onboarding emails, segment your users based on events, and see where your customers get stuck in the product. Start your free trial today at userlist.com. Hey, Lucy.
Hey, Jane. How are you doing?
Doing great. We're so excited to tackle this complex topic with you today. But before we do that, could you tell us a bit more about yourself and what you do and your background story?
Yeah, of course. So I'm Lucy Huskings. I'm an early stage startup marketing advisor, and I've spent the last 10 years or so working in B2B SaaS. I'm also the creator of Oblimey. So Oblimey is a resource for first-time founders and marketers looking to join their first startup. And the idea behind it was it's based on my experience coming in as employee number one or as a member of the founding team. And it's there to help people kind of navigate the messy process of validating an idea and building a startup.
Tell us about your story, where you came from. Did you just, you know, do startup marketing from day one after you went out of school, or was there something different before that?
Yeah, of course. So I actually went to university and I studied media studies, thinking that I would get a job in television. And very, very quickly, I realized that a degree in media studies does not equip you to do that. I always refer to it as being a really expensive way to learn how to do your own washing, because if anything, I just learned how to kind of leave mum and dad and go out into the big bad world. I actually came into marketing via a copywriting job. I was working for a recruitment advertising and applicant tracking system company. And very quickly, I realized that actually my heart was in marketing and product. So over the next couple of years, I'd held marketing manager and marketing director roles for various B2B tech businesses. And it wasn't until the last startup that I'd got involved in, I was the marketing lead for CreaCake, which is an online learning video platform, where I realized actually startup marketing is really quite interesting, because there's often times where you join your first startup and much of what you thought you knew goes out the window. You're no longer that specialist. You're expected to work and deliver much faster than you possibly would have been in a more established business. And you just have to start questioning things. And I think the pull for me with startup marketing is I love the challenge of digging into customer development, digging into customer research, and understanding, is there an idea? Is there a product that can be validated? And ultimately, can you build a sustainable business from it as well?
Who's your ideal client at Oblimey? Is it, you know, day zero, day one startup, or is it somebody who has raised 2 million and wants to deploy them?
That's difficult. I think in terms of who's more straightforward to work with, it's those businesses that have come in and they've secured investment, because they have in part completed some of the work and they've possibly built a case for product market fit. And I say product market fit very loosely, because I don't know if that's actually ever something that you can achieve. But I think even though they're more of a challenge, I do enjoy working with first-time founders who are new to this startup gig, because I think there's this thing where you join a startup and you think it's going to be fun. You think that you're solving this problem for someone. And very, very quickly, you realize that you spend the majority of your time not doing what you love. A lot of the time, you spend your time spinning multiple plates, keeping investors or potential investors happy, talking to customers, and it can be quite challenging. And for me, the challenge behind helping them to articulate their value proposition, work out if there's even a problem that needs solving, looking at the tech, looking at the product, looking at the pricing, just helping them understand whether there's an idea there that can be validated, that can be commercialized and then kind of released into market. That's the fun part. I think in terms of industries, I'm very much, I gravitate to the people industries. So things where tech solves complex people problems. So HR tech, ed tech, anything to do with recruitment. I love the challenge of taking on an Excel spreadsheet and showing that there is a better way to do something.
Yes, by the way, in our pre-recording chat, you mentioned you talking to Johnny Birch, who's one of the Progression co-founders who do HR software. And we had an episode about this a few weeks ago. We're going to link to that in the show notes. It's a small world, indeed.
Yeah, no, brilliant. I've spoken to Johnny a couple of times, and what they're looking to do at Progression, it just seems like an amazing opportunity. I personally think that the market is calling out for the Progression framework that they're looking to kind of put out into people and HR teams. So it's going to be really, really interesting watching them.
In your previous sentence, you mentioned first-time founders. So that second-time founders, they're like, they're lost people, right? They're not optimistic anymore. they are very entrenched realists. What is it?
I think I just must be a bit mad because I just like a challenge. So what I find with founders that have gone through the startup process, yes, they might be a little bit burnt about things, but actually they are a lot more realistic. They know how to delegate. They know possibly how to structure their time a bit more. And they know the kind of fires or the battles to go after and the ones to kind of leave. Whereas with a first-time founder, they're still navigating all of this. And if there's anything that I can do to just make that process a little bit easier based on the mistakes and lessons I've experienced as somebody that's come in from a founding team perspective, then brilliant. I mean, someone said the other day that to work and thrive within a startup environment means that you've got to be a bit crazy. And I completely agree, because you've got to have a growth mindset. You've got to be happy with failure, and you've got to be able to celebrate the small wins. And yeah, we're odd creatures, but it's something that I really love.
Let's talk about that mythical thing. You go to market strategy, and there is, you know, there is positioning, product positioning, and then there is the marketing strategy. And then there is a thing that stands in the middle of that. And we're going to talk about it because it's your, you know, subject of work. How would you define what go to market strategy is?
Okay, so for me, go to market strategy is about launching your new product to a new audience and a new market. So it's different to a marketing strategy. The idea is behind go-to-market, it's the new, it's the first time. So the reason why I started looking into go-to-market strategy is I have had to set them up myself in previous businesses. But I've also spoken to marketers that have joined startups, and they've been sat in board meetings, and the kind of mythical concept of go-to-market pops up, and you realize that actually some founders or some businesses haven't done the research yet. They haven't looked at the size of the market. They haven't really dug into why a customer would even contemplate buying or repeat purchasing their service. And I think it's something that is often left to the last minute. And in my opinion, it should be looked into and built at the same time as you're developing your product, because it takes time researching and testing different channels. The way that people buy, their purchase habits change, how people derive value from a service changes. Just look at COVID and how that has affected the way that people buy things. So I think it's something really, really important. And when I talk about this subject, I kind of delve into three areas. So I look at ways to help startups identify their customers. We also look at the plan into how to reach them. And then lastly, the foundations to scale. So this is where we would look at models, pricing, metrics, that kind of thing. But it's the idea is, it is this package, and how can you get your product to the market?
I always have this mental model of your go-to-market strategy is like, if you're given a chunk of money, what would you do with it to scalably reach out to new customers who have no idea who you are? Mm-hmm. That's my, like, something cold and scalable, you know, as opposed to getting your first 50 customers from friends and family and people who know you personally. And that would not work as you grow, right?
Yeah. So I think it's one of those things where there's a lot of advice out there that talks about how do you secure your first 100 customers? whereas I come at it from the angle of how do you secure your first customer? And what if you don't have those existing networks to dig into and ask for referrals? How do you start cold? And I think from my perspective, it starts off, there's 12 stages in this, and I'm not gonna go really in depth, but what I can do is summarize them into kind of three main parts. But the first one is buyer personas. So I'm not saying anything new here. I'm not professing to do that, but there's this thing where you bring a junior marketer in and they give you this buyer persona. And it very much is something that goes along the lines of Lucy is 37 years old. She's got two dogs. She lives in Cardiff and she likes a beer at the weekend. That doesn't tell you why I bought the top that I'm wearing. It doesn't tell you why I use Deliveroo at 10 o'clock at night to get donuts delivered. It's very much a kind of a stereotypical exercise that you would learn at university. There's nothing there to tell someone or unlock why somebody would buy something. So what I do is I work with founders or marketers to say, okay, well, let's just start seeing if we can find these people that you think that you're going to be selling to. And we want to start building up this idea of the demographics. So if it's B2B SaaS, let's say, what are their job title? Where do they sit within the organization? What kind of industry? What's the level that they occupy within the business, but also things like the psychographics. So what are their goals? What are their challenges? What keeps them up at night? What is standing in the way of them progressing at work? And there are a number of different models out there that can really help you to really dig into this information. So I'm a really, really big fan of Customer Camp. There's a number of different frameworks, but there's one that talks you through how to navigate conversations with customers or potential customers and understand the forces that are at play, the triggers that are at play. So, for example, if I've just bought a Hoover and it's because my Hoover packed up, for example, well, actually, why did I buy that particular one? What was it about the feature set, about this particular shark model? It just gives you a lot more tangible insights that you would then use to impact your positioning, your value proposition, the wording that you might put on landing pages. So you can just start testing adverts to then put out to the colder audiences.
You mentioned that you're a fan of a Customer Camp, which is a framework. Are there any others? Because you said there is at least three or something.
So there's a great resource called Customer Camp. And it is run by a woman called Caitlin. And within this resource, there are a number of tools that can help you manage these customer interviews. So there are call sheets, there are structured survey and interview questions. And the idea is that it talks you through how to navigate that conversation with the customer, to understand the triggers, to understand the forces that are at play that would influence a purchase decision or influence whether they would buy from yourself. So that's a really, really good resource. That's Customer Camp. Also a massive fan of a book called The Mom Test by Fitzpatrick as well. I mean, we used that at Career Cake, a startup I was working at, and that was mind-blowingly awesome into how it changed our conversations, because we realized that we were asking biased questions. We were people-pleasing. We were talking to the people that said that they loved their product, even though they would never buy our product. So yeah, that was a really, really useful tool as well.
That book really revolutionized the way I talk to people, not just customers, a lot of people, because mm-hmm. Our everyday conversations are just so biased. It's no way to do research. Absolutely no.
It's weird because it also made me realize that actually when I'm having a down day, I do want to speak to my mum and ask her opinion, because she can lie, but she'll make me feel great, but it's absolutely fine. But it's interesting because it was a lot of the, many times I speak to founders and they tell me that they speak to leads and the lead tells them that they absolutely love their product. And the lead might sign up, but they never activate or they never actually use the product. And things like the Mom Test are really useful because you can actually dig deep into kind of the justification or, I don't know, the reason why somebody said yes in the first place. And you realize that actually it's because you're asking the wrong people. People, it's human nature not to want to let people down. And I just, it's a really effective way of kind of removing those biases and getting closer to actually what somebody thinks of your product, understanding more effectively the kind of the jobs to be done, like why they are hiring your product in the first place. So yeah, really, really useful tool.
Well, let's talk about channels. The first resource that comes to mind is the Traction book by Gabriel Weinberg and everybody who quotes that. But I hope you have something more than that on the table.
Oh, well, that was the first resource I was going to mention. No, so I think when it comes to acquisition channels, it depends on a number of things, what you end up using. So the stage that your startup's at, how saturated some of those channels are because you might have competitors, and ultimately how your customers research and buy a product like yours. The choice of acquisition channels are also impacted on things like, are you a sales-led business or are you a product-led business? Are you going to be top-down selling? Are you going to be bottom-up selling? So there's so many different factors here. So you're right, there is a book called Traction, and there are 19 available. But if you give that to a first-time founder, they will become so overwhelmed. I'm a marketer and I was overwhelmed. There's 19 different channels. So yes, you've got viral, events, sales, BD, SEO. But you've also got to consider actually, where do these channels fit within the buying process of your customer? So you might look at the stages awareness, consideration, or decision. You might look at struggle, evaluation, growth. You've got to work out where these channels fit within certain points of the buying decision as well. So one model that I found that has been really, really useful is by Rachitsky and Hockenmeyer. And they put out this article, and it's predominantly for B2C companies, but I actually think that there's a lot of things that you can borrow from a B2B perspective here. And what they do is they advise taking some of these channels and grouping them into growth lanes. So, for example, a growth lane would be performance marketing. This could be where your search ads or Facebook might be. Another growth lane might be viral. So it could be where word of mouth lives. And the last one could be content. So it's where your SEO or your content marketing strategy is. And you would pick one of these channels based on how somebody would interact with your product. So if somebody's not naturally looking for your product, you might be more successful with looking at the traction channels that live within performance marketing. Let's say, for example, you publish content and your content is user generated. Let's say it's based on reviews or YouTube channel type content. Well, then you might be more likely to focus on something like the content growth lane as well. So it's an interesting way to group them, because once you've picked a growth lane, you've got the choice of one or two traction channels to really kind of dig into, because you can't look at all 19. That's bonkers. Anybody that looks at all 19 isn't necessarily going to get that far. And I read an article about how businesses have used these. So, for example, I've got a couple of examples here of brands and their early stage acquisition channels. So the first one, hugely obvious, Dropbox. The two that they focused on were referrals and word of mouth. Like, everybody knows about Dropbox and how you would be invited to this storage, cloud-based storage system. And you just thought, oh my God, this is revolutionary. Look at things like Canva. So Canva's two traction channels, at least at the beginning, were viral marketing and content partnerships. Then you've got Salesforce. There's were sales and events. So you can see how these brands actually started and realize, actually, let's play to our strengths. Let's only focus on a couple of acquisition channels and see where we go. Typically, when I work with early stage startups, they might test about four, but it's usually my advice to really hammer down on and focus on two, because you're still learning. You're still learning about how your audience buys. You're still learning what your product could be helping them to solve in the long term as well. But I think that's a really useful framework, because you can see how these companies actually kind of grew their reach as well.
Let's talk about scaling. And there is a wonderful dichotomy of sales-led and product-led growth. And product-led is such a hot word these days. It's like probably replacing growth hacking and all that, even though they're kind of different. What's your take? What makes product-led companies different from sales-led? Does product-led automatically mean self-serve or not so much?
To me, product-led growth is a go-to-market strategy whereby you rely on your platform to help acquire, retain, and grow your customers. So it's very much reliant on a kind of a bottom-up sales approach. So everything about that product needs to be spot on because it's the product experience that is moving that customer along the customer lifecycle. Typically, again, in my opinion, these businesses or these products are a lot more simple or easy to use. The value that they offer is there immediately. They'll probably have a very good onboarding process. Whereas if you look at a business that is sales-led, typically it's because the product itself is going to be complex. As soon as you introduce a sales team or sales-led approach, you know that there's going to be a high CAC, which means that actually the average order is going to be a lot higher as well. And I've worked in businesses where I've worked for a product-led business and a sales-led business. That's definitely thrown up different types of challenges. So with a sales-led business, the kind of average order of product we were selling was about £50,000. And that would take about a year to close. And that very much involved me as a marketer working with the sales team to generate leads, to nurture leads, and kind of help them through that process. Whereas with a product-led growth platform such as CreaCake, for example, we are very much reliant on it there being a low CAC. We needed our onboarding to be spot on because you've only got one opportunity here. And yeah, they both throw up very, very kind of different approaches. And I think it just depends on kind of that job that the customer's looking to get. But if I had to choose, definitely my favorite would be product-led growth. It's just a really, really interesting concept. And I think the number of MarTech tools that are out there at the moment to help marketers and help product people grow their users they're just phenomenal. But a really good resource for this, and I'm sure you're aware, but just in case, is Wes Bush's product-led growth book. That's just a really, really, really useful tool.
Wes Bush has a whole community around it. I think it's one of the largest product communities I know at the moment. Really great job there. They have a spectacular Slack, like it's giant. It's one of my to-dos, like eternally to spend more time there because it's just a gigantic pool of information and opinions and everything. So recommended. I'm going to link to that in the show notes.
Oh yeah, no, it's brilliant. I think once I had read Wes's book, I had that aha moment. I had that moment where I went, do you know what? Actually, this is all fitting into place. And product-led growth, sales-led growth are really, really important frameworks. Another framework to add into that is obviously the customer-led growth framework as well. That's something that the team over at Forget the Funnel talk quite often as well. So these tools are kind of very interchangeable, but ideally they're just a really good tool of understanding kind of your customers better and what your kind of route to market is going to be.
And I'm glad that you mentioned onboarding because it is a crucial part of the experience. But just to say that onboarding doesn't always depend on the effort that the team puts in. For example, UserList is a pretty complex product to adopt. And as much as we try to make the onboarding smooth and nice, it's never going to be one-click setup as, you know, Calendly or SaviCal. You just one-click set up your calendar, like to set up your two slots for your availability, you're good to go. There's the aha moment. UserList? Mm-mm. No, so it's more like when you pick your battle as a founder, you've got to think about that already because it's defined by the product, not just your onboarding efforts. Extra slideshow is not going to take you to an easy onboarding. So it's not just the effort that counts.
No, definitely. And you know what? I saw a tweet this morning. I can't remember who it was by, but what I saw a really interesting example of an onboarding process was, you know how you sometimes get a checklist, upload your logo and, I don't know, invite a user or something. It was interesting because for every action that you did, it gave you an additional day added to your free trial. And it's, I'm just seeing different ways and different ways people are experimenting with. But yeah, it's ultimately understanding that customer's aha moment. And it's hugely different by industry and by product. So,
yeah, those gamified trials, as we call them.
Oh.
I think Jana Bastow of ProdPad was the one to make it kind of popular a few years ago.
Okay.
But I think it's a great concept if you have developer resources on hand to make it happen, because it definitely requires some work. There was an article that I found maybe a month ago or something. I totally don't remember the name of the author, but we're going to link to that in the show notes. They talk about the scale where of a customer acquisition cost versus and lifetime value versus marketing channels that you're going to use to get to them. On one hand, there's a low CAC, high virality, you know, a few just one or two touch points so you can sell to them via ads and stuff. And then the other side of the spectrum is sales-led products, high LTV, high ARPU, whatever. And there is this middle of selling to small to medium businesses like Avoid, where it's really hard because your ARPU is not large enough to justify sales efforts. And also you're already unable to sell quickly through like some viral / ads or something like that. Do you have your opinion on that?
It's interesting because when you were describing that, my mind instantly went to the product pricing matrix that Intercom put together. And it's I've included it in the go-to-market playbook available on my website. And ultimately, you've got quadrants. So the bottom left is self-serve. So it's low CAC, it's low value. The product is less complex. On the top right, I have to think about that, you've got the enterprise. So you've got the high CAC, the really complex enterprise product, more likely to have a sales team. On the left, which I think is possibly the area that you might be referring to here, they call that the transactional. So it's kind of the mid-market where there's an opportunity to sell from this market, but actually maybe they need a bit more hand-holding. It's not as clear-cut. At least this is my interpretation of the framework anyway. And they use a few ways, or they suggest a few ways to grow that based around things like usage-based pricing. And that's where you start trialing different pricing tiers and whatever your pricing offering might be. But I don't know, for me, for businesses that I've worked in where there isn't quite a clear cut space for that type of product, it almost lends itself to a wider positioning exercise, really. Do you want to be known as that kind of enterprise led tool, or is it better to be the self-serve tool? I don't know. But yeah, if it was based on the experience I've been in, we've tended to not focus on that area that we're not very good at, or we realize that we don't see the returns that we're after because we kind of would prefer to play to our strengths. But that could be indicative of the industries that I've been in.
I think it's great time for some examples, some case studies from your experience. You've briefly mentioned, you know, a few popular products like Dropbox being referrals, et cetera, for their like go-to-market strategy that worked. Some more of those, and also maybe some more of companies from your particular experience.
So if I give you an example of how CareerCake, the startup that I was involved in, kind of navigated this go-to-market strategy. So just a little bit of background. CareerCake is an online video learning tool. And the idea is that we would provide content or careers content to young professionals looking to rise to beat the challenges that they're going to face within the first decade of their career. So what made CareerCake different from the market was its roots were in a YouTube channel. And what we found was the work that the founder, Amy, had put in was amassing like 3-4 million views for these videos. And what we found is that actually there wasn't a market for careers advice that spoke to people about the stuff that you don't necessarily want to talk about. So let's say you went for a promotion and you didn't get it. How do you show face? You've just had a really awkward conversation and you want to criticize your boss. We would talk about things like that, or imposter syndrome. So the idea was that we wanted to take this to market, not via a YouTube channel. So when I first started, there were a series of courses. I think there was about 5 or 6. And the idea is that you would go to the website, very similar to Udemy, you sign, put your credit card in, have access to that course for 30 days. But the problem that we were finding was that students, or the people using it rather, couldn't dish out money to watch a course every single time. They wanted more of like an a la carte Netflix style model where they could watch videos at the point of pain, it's known as. They wanted not to be capped on their kind of viewing rates as well. So with this, we thought, well, how can we make Career Cake successful for the commercial market? How can we sell into HR teams and people and learning development teams? So the idea and how we kind of navigated through the acquisition channels was that we added new products to our offering. So not only were we doing videos just for people at the beginning of their career, but we would support them to go for the first promotion, to become a manager and whatnot. And we would sell this to people that predominantly work with early careers. So people that are working with those young apprentices that are coming through their business. So how do these people buy? So typically we found that they love content marketing. So for the niche that we were selling to, it was relatively kind of old hat. They love a PDF. They love their events. That's where they get their information from. But what was interesting was this was a couple of years before COVID. We saw this appetite for online learning, and we saw this interest in learning management systems as well. So we figured that there was something there. So our acquisition channels were SEO, content marketing. So that is things like white papers, educational content to say this is a different way to deliver careers activity, and also sales. At this point, we were still early stage. We didn't necessarily know how to articulate our value proposition. So we would market Career Cake. We would get our leads coming through from these B2B audiences. People would request a free trial. We'd phone up, understand kind of like what their pain point was, and try to work out whether there was a fit for Career Cake as well. A couple of months later, we were at a point where we felt as though we had the appropriate conversion rates that we could start automating things. And actually we turned our business model into a product-led model. So the acquisition channels that we were using were SEO and content marketing, and they were coming in, people were onboarding and being able to watch the content from that perspective.
I'm always curious, content marketing sounds so easy to just, you know, go for, especially, I mean, you take every niche that's a little bit in depth in terms of knowledge, there you go. But how do you make it work? How do you decide on what type of content will resonate with people, and B, what type of content will be good for SEO? This don't always overlap.
Yeah, no, I think in terms of what makes content marketing work, from my experience, is first of all, speaking to your customers and working out what their objections are at each stage of the buying process. So, for example, when I was working for an applicant tracking system provider, we wanted to sell to mid-market HR teams who knew that they needed to automate their recruitment process, but they were worried that as soon as you brought in some form of technology, there was a threat to their job. And so can you imagine having to create content around helping them to realize that we're not trying to replace you, and we're just trying to replace the fact that you are using Excel spreadsheets to manage 500 CVs coming through, for example. So what we did and what I found really useful was we would actually go and sit in the offices of these HR teams, because we wanted to understand the context that they were using or they could be using our platform. And very, very quickly, we realized that HR is one of the most chaotic environments you can ever work in. Not only are you having to manage people, contracts, hiring, firing, performance reviews, but also in some businesses, HR doesn't actually have representation at the board. So they're always trying to have to fight for their credibility almost, even though HR is one of the most or the most important part in a business. So we realized that actually there's a bit of an emotional sell here as well. So what we would do is we would look at the alternatives, and we found that a competitor to us would be Excel, but also you've got HR bolt-ons. So you've got a HR system that kind of does a bit of recruitment. So it was very interesting navigating all these different tools that were fighting for this person's attention. And as a result, we would create blogs educating people, saying, actually, if you were to consider our system over and above an Excel spreadsheet, this will help you in terms of quality, in terms of streamlining. And then it wasn't until we started to get further along, we realized that as we got the buy-in and people said, okay, do you know what? I understand this through your content. I understand this. Now we've got a problem. I'm getting sign-off to buy your physical system, because actually I've got to go through procurement and I've got to talk to my boss and bits and pieces. So at that point, we actually identified an opportunity in this one business to build a downloadable kit on how to build a business case for recruitment software. And it was a template that they could pop their numbers in, give it to their boss and say, look, here's the potential returns, because they needed help to articulate but also visualize the kind of what the result would be if they subscribe to our platform. And what made our content marketing strategy work for us, SEO actually became our biggest lead source. The average order value, the cumulative order value from SEO leads, was like, it paid for itself. It's actually the biggest lead source still for that company. But we would speak about very particular problems. We were operating in this competitive environment where people would just talk about how to save money on your recruitment. But it wasn't until we made a point of creating content for the end user that acknowledged the emotional and the physical problems and challenges that they were trying to face that we started to get traction. We were fortunate enough to get inbound links coming in from various sources that started to quote us, which obviously helped with our visibility and our credibility as well. And we were also very lucky that as I was growing the team, we decided to hire writers, because as a startup, we knew that actually this channel is where our customers are researching and buying this particular product. And also we knew that by hiring writers, it was something that we could kind of churn out very, very quickly. It wasn't something that we needed to outsource. We also signed up to HubSpot. This was back a few years ago as well. And definitely the lead nurturing aspect of things helped us to convert these customers, because it was an enterprise sales model at that point. But I probably rambled a bit, but that was definitely got to be my favorite content marketing project I've ever been involved in.
As we're wrapping up today's episode, could you give us one do and one don't for founders and product managers who are working on their go-to-market strategy?
Yes. So my one do would be not only speak to your customers, but speak to your customers in their environment. And I appreciate that a lot of us are going to be remote working at the moment, but if there is an opportunity to understand how your customer is going to use your product in their environment, you can see what is fighting for their attention. You can see the competitors that are coming into their inbox. You could see, I don't know, the influence that their boss might have or their colleagues might have. Only then will you truly understand actually what your product has the capability to be, but also how it might be adopted and engaged with by your customer and their team as well.
That's great advice. And the don't?
Okay, and my don't would be, if you're interested in joining a startup, do not get sucked into the sales pitch. So if you are going in as the first marketer or the first product marketer, for example, and you're really energized by the startup founder's vision and story, that's great. But you need to do a bit of homework. You need to understand the market that they're operating in, whether they've actually got product market fit. And by that, I mean, have they actually spoken to a customer? Sounds a bit mean, but it happens. And also, what is their understanding of your discipline? Because particularly with marketing, I do wonder if a marketer has ever actually gone into a job and not had to educate somebody on what they do on a day-to-day basis. I do wonder whether a marketer's job is 75% telling people what they do and 25% actually executing. So I think the sales pitch is great, but just don't be afraid to kind of dig into those questions, because ultimately it's going to help your sanity. It's going to help you understand how quickly you're going to be able to pick up that product as well.
That's great advice. That's legitimate for every startup job, I think. But, you know, if you come to an interview and say, hey, but what's your MRR? At least that will give you respect, you know. They might not exactly answer, but definitely it shows that you have an idea how they operate financially.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it shows that you're interested in the business. It shows that you care. And yeah, I think it just, it stops or reduces any awkward conversations when you actually lift the bonnet and see what's going on.
And to finalize this, where can people find more of your wisdom online and maybe sign up for your services or anything like that?
Yeah, of course. So if you want to learn more about early stage marketing, if you're a first time founder or you are the marketer going in and joining your first tech startup, if you head over to my website, which is oblimey.com, if you go on there, you'll see my blog. I update it every fortnight. There's a few resources. So there's a downloadable go-to-market playbook you can use. There's also a couple of resources on how to really dig into customer development as well. I'm also on Twitter as Lucy_Heskins, and I'm also on LinkedIn as well.
Amazing. Thanks so much, Lucy, for sharing your wisdom today. This was awesome, and have a wonderful rest of your week.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you found the episode useful, please spread the word about this new show on Twitter, mentioning Userlist, or leave us a review on iTunes.